You've been charged with a crime. You have the right to an attorney. But what if you live in rural South Dakota? And what if you can't pay? From SDPB, today is Thursday, October 2nd. This is In the Moment. Coming up this hour, the Sixth Amendment and South Dakota. We'll look at indigent defense in the state and efforts to create a statewide system that works more efficiently. Earlier this year, we became the last state to remove the full cost burden for indigent defense from counties. Now we have a statewide office. What's next? We'll hear from South Dakota Supreme Court Chief Justice Stephen Jensen, Dean Neil Fulton of the USD Law School, and Court Administrator Greg Satizon. Plus, the U.S. Supreme Court readies for a new term. We have got a preview after the news. We're broadcasting today from SDPB's Kirby Family Studio in Sioux Falls. I'm Lori Walsh. You're in the moment. News is first. You're listening to In the Moment on SDPB. I'm Lori Walsh. The U.S. Supreme Court begins a new session next week. The court has agreed to hear a case that might sound somewhat familiar to South Dakotans. United States v. Scrimeti looks at a law passed in Tennessee regarding medical treatment for minors. Also, Garland v. Vanderstock. That's a case that looks at so-called ghost guns and how they might be regulated or not regulated. Mike Thompson is an associate professor of criminal justice at the University of Sioux Falls. He explains Tennessee Senate Bill 1.
You can't provide treatment for gender dysphoria to minors. And the court goes through the history of treatment for individuals suffering from a lack of alignment between their biological sex and their perceived gender. And so Tennessee and Kentucky passed laws that prevent that for minors. Doesn't prevent it for adults, but prevents the treatment for minors. And the court goes through, the Court of Appeals goes through a long history of how these conditions have been addressed medically. And then it comes down to sort of the posture of the case at the time the court gets it. The people who are challenging the law want an injunction. They want the court to say, no, the law can't go into effect until we litigate the merits of it. And the merits of it is whether it violates due process and or equal protection. That's what the lower courts looked at. This U.S. Supreme Court, when it granted the writ of certiorari to hear it, confined the issue only to the equal protection argument and not the due process argument.
What's the significance of that confinement?
So the due process clause has a procedural component and a substantive component. So the procedural component says that if the government's taken action against me, I'm entitled to notice and a meaningful opportunity to be heard. That's the procedural part. The substantive part is something that justices like Clarence Thomas are very far against, because the substantive part is the U.S. Supreme Court recognizing that there are certain protections that are implicit in the concept of ordered liberty that are part of the Due Process Clause. So the fact that the court took it only on equal protection grounds and not on substantive due process, I think, is probably to avoid a big rumbling amongst them all about what do we do with substantive due process, and equal protection is just easier.
Yeah,
I think.
So this is a family, a group of families who have in Tennessee who have said this is creating quite a hardship for us. The South Dakotans are fairly familiar with this because we in 2023 had our own law, which the proponents of which said was protecting children from harmful medical acts. And the opponents said you are denying best practices healthcare for transgender kids, and now we have to go out of state. So we understand the two sides of this. Same thing that's happening here.
Same thing.
Essentially the same arguments.
Same thing. And the parents bring up the argument that we have the right to guide our kids' as medical care. And that is true. That is a substantive right under the Due Process Clause. The parents have that kind of control, the substantive due process right to raise their children.
And I
don't think that argument's going to make it to the U.S. Supreme Court because of the way this the court framed the issue.
But all right. So what are the key questions before the court then?
Again, we've got the court can dwell in the procedural part of the case, which is, okay, this is a request for a preliminary injunction. We're not on the merits of it. One of the factors we have to consider is whether there's a likelihood of success, whether the plaintiffs, the people who are challenging the law, whether they have a likelihood of success. So the court could stick on that. Preliminary injunction is a pretty extraordinary remedy. So I don't think they will stick on that because of the way they framed the issue. They don't talk about the injunction or anything. They talk about whether the Kentucky and Tennessee laws violate equal protection. And both the Tennessee and Kentucky courts said that their laws treat similarly situated individuals even-handedly. So
say more about that.
So the everybody who is, and I'm not a medical doctor, so I hope I don't get all this wrong, but people who are minors who are suffering from gender dysphoria, the law treats them all equally by saying what can and can't be done. So that's what the lower courts have said. And so the government, U.S. Supreme Court, is going to have to determine whether that's
correct. So it's the families who are trying to get the higher court to listen to them.
Right.
But so far, they have been on the losing end of this.
Yep, they've been on the losing end. The lower courts have said, you're not likely to succeed on the merits of this. So we're denying the injunction and to stop the law. If the U.S. Supreme Court says that the Equal Protection Clause applies and that these people are being treated according to their sex, which is a suspect class, then we're going to get up into a level of scrutiny where the Tennessee law might not survive.
Just and that's what this is all about.
That's just what
this
it's
is all about. It's whether or not transgender people exist.
Yeah, whether transgender people fit within that category of sex that is a suspect class, which means that anytime the government draws a line, and the government is always discriminating, not necessarily illegally, but they're always drawing lines and making choices, when they make that choice based on sex, then the courts say, well, wait a minute, you can't do that unless you've got a compelling interest, and the way you're going at it is narrowly tailored to achieve that interest. I think that's where the court's going to end up. I think they're going to say that, yeah, you're discriminating based on sex. And a protection of the minor, this is my lame prediction probably, but the protection of the minor, while it might be a compelling interest, this isn't a narrow way to achieve that interest. I don't know. I think personally that the Tennessee and Kentucky are going to, that who these laws are in trouble. I think that's why the court took it. I don't think they're going to agree with the lower courts that these statutes are constitutional.
Now, help me understand this. This is not new. Transgender people and getting health care is not new.
Right. Yep.
But some of these laws prohibiting it are fairly new. So it would not be unusual for us to see this churn out in the courts for quite some time. Or is there established law about this, and this is just a political game? Are we creating new laws for something that we understand that we didn't understand before, or are we just playing politics with the courts?
Calls for a subjective opinion. I think the latter is true, that it's playing politics with
the
courts.
It's a really political thing right now.
We're trying to find a venue that will be that will accept our views.
So what kind of arguments and questions are you listening for? What are your ears perked up for?
They're perked up for whether the court determines that the protection of minors in this instance is compelling. Is this a compelling interest that the state has? It's got to be a compelling interest of the state to protect minors from these procedures. And even if the due process clause is not part of this, there are a whole bunch of cases talking about the parents' right over their minor children. Those are long-standing rules in the constitutional jurisprudence.
So what do we know precedent-wise about parental right to be informed of and know about and make decisions about your child's health care?
It's very well protected, very well protected. There are very few cases that infringe on parents' right to rear their child, which includes what do I treat them for medically?
Ghost guns. Garland v. Vanderstock.
Garland, yes. This is a statutory construction case. The Gun Control Act of 1968. It defines a firearm as any weapon, yada yada, which will or is designed, mortally converted to expel a projectile by the action of an explosive. In addition to the, and the statute says this, the actual Gun Control Act says, in addition to the frame or receiver of any such weapon. The act does not, however, define a frame or a receiver. So the problem is the ghost guns are buying a kit online and being able to put this gun together, and it has no serial number, it has no way to be tracked.
Here's what I don't understand. This whole idea of taking it apart, is it a gun? Every gun can be taken apart.
Sure.
Right? All guns can be taken apart. So a kit doesn't seem to me that much different than a disassembled firearm. If you put it together,
right,
it becomes a gun.
Right.
So what's happening here with the, is this a simple definition?
Uh-huh. This is a simple act of ATF decides that, well, since the statute doesn't define frame or receiver, the ATF is going to. And so the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms then defined it and included it in the definition of a weapon or a firearm, which means that takes out all these kits out of circulation. And the contest is over whether the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms, whether that was an overstep, whether they violated the plain language of the Gun Control Act by defining frame or receiver.
Mike Thompson is an associate professor of criminal justice at the University of Sioux Falls. We'll have more with him and the upcoming United States Supreme Court session next week. You're listening to In the Moment on SDPB. I'm Lori Walsh. The Sixth Amendment of the U.S. Constitution guarantees that a person accused of a crime has the right to legal defense. Now, indigent defense refers to the representation of people who are unable to pay for those legal services. Until this year, South Dakota was the last state in the nation where counties had the full financial burden of providing legal counsel for people who can't pay. The South Dakota State Legislature created a task force to explore better options. At the end of this September, a new report from the United Judicial System outlined challenges and recommendations. So today we will hear from South Dakota Supreme Court Chief Justice Stephen Jensen, Dean Neil Fulton of the University of South Dakota Knutson School of Law and Chair of the newly created Office of Indigent Defense, and Greg Satizon, South Dakota's State Court Administrator. We start here with Chief Justice Jensen.
So this first came up, we really started talking about it as a court system probably about 3 years ago, and there were a confluence of factors that really led to our concerns with the indigent defense system in South Dakota. The first were just observations and also hearing from judges around the state that, particularly in rural areas, that were struggling to find court-appointed lawyers to handle cases, and especially in some of the more serious felony charges. The second issue that really focused our attention on indigent defense was hearing from a number of counties that were struggling to pay for indigent defense costs and were identifying the same issues with finding attorneys to provide representation in their counties. A third issue was in front of us related to attorney compensation, and particularly the absence of any compensation for lawyers that sometimes drive hours round trip to provide court-appointed representation in rural counties. And then the last issue really just being the decentralized nature of the county-run indigent defense system, the struggles with that in terms of management and oversight of the really what's become a pretty significantly large system. And so within these discussions, we talked about the idea of putting a study group together and approach the legislature in 2023 about formally authorizing a study group by legislation, and the legislature did do that. We held listening sessions, conducted research, worked with the Sixth Amendment Center over the next 9 months, and presented a report recommending specific legislation and really two things in that legislation. One was to create a statewide commission to manage the indigent defense system in the state. And then the second recommendation to create a state public defender office, with the initial scope of that office to be for the purpose of handling criminal, juvenile, and habeas corpus appeals to the Supreme Court. So in this legislative session, 2024, the legislature enacted those recommendations and also provided funding for the state public defender office. And the other piece of that, and one of the reasons why we've been talking about indigent defense here lately, is part of the recommendation from that original study group in 2023 was to bring in the Sixth Amendment Center to do a more in-depth study of a number of our counties to see what was going on, particularly at the trial court level. Right now, we don't have any way to do that, and we tried to gather information. It was really haphazard to do that, and so we asked them to come in and assist us with that project, and they just put out a report here in the last couple of weeks that has really, I guess I would say, both identified and confirmed some of the issues that we were hearing and seeing over the course of the past 2 or 3 years.
Yeah. I want to bring Dean Neil Fulton into the conversation here. And Dean Fulton, first of all, you're welcome to add to what the chief said here. But one of the key things I'm hearing is this is a system that's not working for the people of South Dakota. Am I overstepping by saying that?
Yeah, I mean, I would say that's overstatement. I mean, I think it's a system that has some fundamental strengths and some fundamental challenges, which, you know, is to say it's a system. So I think that one of the things that you see that really works in South Dakota is there is a strong commitment by private lawyers to undertake appointed work. And I think regardless of how much progress we make on the statewide office, there's going to be a need for local lawyers to take criminal cases. And that's a fundamental strength that we build from. It's just a significant commitment to justice here in South Dakota. Second, I think, you know, the system is strong in that we have strong support from the judiciary. It's not every jurisdiction where the Chief Justice makes it a signature initiative legislatively to push forward indigent defense. That is reflective, I think, of the commitment from the judiciary across the board to indigent defense. And we saw in the task force, it's not just the judiciary, but we saw commitment by county government, by prosecutors, by law enforcement, by other folks to say, hey, this is a thing that we need to do because an effective, efficient indigent defense system is good for all South Dakotans. Now, having said that, there are significant challenges, right? I mean, the availability of lawyers in rural areas is a significant challenge. The geography of South Dakota is a significant challenge when you talk about detention facilities that may be an hour or more from the courthouse where that case is venued. When you talk about the complexity of high stakes, you know, high-level criminal litigation and getting that expertise out there. So, you know, do we have a lot of work to do? I agree with you. Yeah, we do. But do we work from a position of some fundamental strengths? I also think that's true.
Talk to me as if, Dean Fulton, I was an incoming law student, and help me understand why this is an area of the law that might have promise for me, that might be professionally rewarding in a unique way.
Well, I mean, the first thing I would say is that, you know, having done indigent defense myself, that the ability to listen to a client who maybe has never had anyone listen to them, to give them honest and accurate advice without self-interest, and they've probably never had someone who's given them accurate, honest advice devoid of self-interest, and then to stand up in court and tell that person's story without fear or favor is just a remarkable opportunity as a lawyer. I would say that it's providing fundamental human dignity to those clients. Not a lot of spots in life where you get to say that you, day in and day out, affirm the fundamental human dignity of the people you're working with. Having said that, it's incredibly challenging work. The complexity of the issues is intellectually fascinating, the opportunity to be in court. And some lawyers really want to be in court and try cases. This is the spot where cases get tried. Many fewer civil cases get tried than they used to. Not that many criminal cases get tried, but as a percentage, right, of the total out there, it's just a lot more, and the opportunity is great. So I would tell you, it's incredibly rewarding work. It's incredibly steady work, and it's incredibly challenging work. And if you're a young lawyer, that should be really appealing to you.
Yeah. Greg Satt is on as state court administrator and as somebody who worked on the committee project staff. Tell me a little bit about some of the challenges that you see in the system and then some of the ways you saw this group of people come together to try to understand them and then make recommendations to address them.
Yeah, I think it was a really great process. We do know that there's a lot of challenges. You know, that's how we got into, you know, being willing to have a very public discussion about what are the challenges in our system. And, you know, some of the big challenges I think revolve around the financial aspect of our current system is almost completely reliant on the counties. And so how do we have our counties who are very, very different in their population and the types of services they need for legal services and their ability to provide those, and then how they've approached providing indigent defense services. And so that's led to a very patchwork system. And I think that was something our task force was able to identify right away. We have some counties with public defender's offices that are staffed with full-time professional people that, you know, live and breathe this and have that passion. You know, others rely on lawyers to volunteer to take those kind of cases. And, you know, we heard judges say how difficult it can be for them to actively try to recruit people to take cases in their jurisdictions. So that availability and the willingness to take those cases, the fact that financially it creates a hardship on some of those lawyers for taking those cases, particularly ones that are going to last for a significant length of time. And we know there are a lot of challenges. And I do think, you know, as we talked about this, from the court system's perspective, and the Chief Justice has been very clear about this, is it is about how do we improve the system, not necessarily, you know, the funding piece comes along with that, but it's really about system improvement. And, you know, having the chance to work with the task force, whether it was a county commissioner or a state's attorney or someone doing criminal defense or a judge, it was very clear that there was a lot of interest in making sure that our system was better. And people kind of set aside their own personal interests in that system to think about globally, where are our challenges? How can we overcome those as a state? And so I think that led to a really good project or report from our task force that kind of set the stage toward the legislative discussion. And then ultimately, when you see the report that just came out, it really confirms a lot of the things that our task force had talked about in our short period of time to work on this topic.
Greg, was the information available? Did we have enough information to gather? Is it being tracked? When you say that the, you know, counties are responsible for so much of it, it would occur to me that without that statewide oversight, it might be hard to get all the information that you need. Tell me a little bit about the information gathering part.
Yeah, that was definitely a challenge. Every county keeps their information a little bit differently. And currently, there's not a lot of incentives in the way our system is built. Our best source of information was from a fund that the state operates that reimburses a small amount of court-appointed attorney fees back to the counties based on how many cases that they've had. But that was an aggregate amount for the county. And so we really didn't have the opportunity to look really closely at certain case types that are driving the expense. So, for instance, we had a lot of discussion about, you know, how many of these cases and how much of this expense is associated with high-level felony cases, or is it a lot of lower-level felony cases that are just the volume is driving the expense? From the data, we were not able to break down, you know, what those drivers look like. And so, you know, that ability to have the data. Another good example, I think, on the data is just understanding court-appointed lawyers, how many cases they have in our system to get a feel for what their workload is. You know, we can do that on a county basis, but we couldn't do it across counties very effectively, and we certainly couldn't do it statewide. And definitely the third layer is if they're working in the federal system, we had zero data about that. And so it was really hard to figure out as a system how much pressure exists on lawyers to get those cases completed, or do they have the time, and are they available to complete those cases? So that data piece was a significant challenge. Very hopeful, though, that through the statewide commission and the office, that as we start to gather more and more of those pieces, it's really going to inform the public policy discussion that has to continue in those areas that we need to see improvement in.
Chief Jensen, how common is our system when we look at what's happening in other states?
Yeah, you know, I would say that if you go back 50 or 100 years, and of course our system of court-appointed counsel and indigent defense goes back to Dakota territorial days, it was much more of a situation where local governments funded the expense and the cost of court-appointed attorneys. Over the years, states have begun moving to and recognizing that counties can't absorb those costs. There needs to be more oversight. And so more and more states have moved toward a state-run system. When we started the legislative session in this past January, we were the only state in the country that did not have a statewide oversight of indigent defense, and we now have that. So that's a huge step for us, and it will significantly improve, as Greg alluded to, some of our ability to gather data and oversee what's going on throughout the state. And so that's huge. And then, of course, the other piece of it is the funding part, and that's really a mix across the country. There are some states that the state funds the entire indigent defense budget. There are other states where it's a mix of counties and state. And, you know, right now, before 2024, the state was reimbursing about 2% roughly of the costs that counties were incurring for indigent defense. That's going to go up this next year. It's probably going to be closer to 5-7% as a result of the appellate office opening. But long term, I think there's going to have to be a discussion about where do we go as a state, and is more of that funding going to come from the state? Is it going to be a mix of state and local? What does that look like? That's a policy discussion that, as Greg alluded to, we don't really want to get into. Our big concern is we want to make sure we have adequate funding and that we have a system that works well.
Are we playing catch up, Chief?
Oh, I think so. In some respects, I mean, one of the things that I've alluded to several times and I think is significant is we were an early adopter in South Dakota back in the 1800s of recognizing the need for indigent defense. And so we've got a rich history and tradition of recognizing that. We can go up to 1963 when Gideon versus Wainwright was decided by the U.S. Supreme Court and said that states are required to pay for indigent defense. There were a lot of states that weren't paying for felony cases, only certain felony cases, and we're not providing indigent defense. South Dakota's provided it for felonies and misdemeanors for over 100 years. So it's a little bit of mix in that we have this rich tradition, but we're a little bit behind now in terms of the structure and the management oversight and funding. Although I will tell you that, you know, a lot of states struggle with funding indigent defense. It's not probably only an issue that we see in South Dakota.
Sure. Dean Fulton, what can you tell us about the Sixth Amendment Center and the partnership there? Help us understand who that is and what they're providing.
Yeah, so the Sixth Amendment Center is a national organization that, you know, is really committed to giving life to the Sixth Amendment guarantee of counsel for any citizen who is charged with a crime. So, you know, to think about that, you have to go back and think what the Sixth Amendment means in the United States. Before the full force of the government can be brought to bear against you, you have a right to an expert to explain the laws to you, to advocate what those laws mean. And we think that's so important that if you are not able to afford a lawyer yourself, we provide one for you so that, you know, we even the scales, whether you are the president of the United States or the poorest citizen in the United States when you are charged with a crime. So the Sixth Amendment Center collects data. They study best practices across the country. They have come in and done a study like this in a variety of jurisdictions. They're very transparent that they're nonpartisan, that their real interest is in helping states identify what an effective system of indigent defense looks like in that jurisdiction. They're definitely transparent that they're going to provide information about national best practices, but then help jurisdictions identify what's going on, for in our case in South Dakota, to make those two things marry up. And, you know, I just have to say that Aditi Jail and David Carroll from the Sixth Amendment Center have just been tremendous partners. They were very genuinely curious to understand South Dakota. They didn't come in with a preconceived notion. They really tried to find the facts and provide input to the task force and now the commission about what's out there and how we can improve what we already have.
Yeah. Dean Fulton, are there plans to, you know, provide training or guidance for attorneys to how to do this well? What is the growth opportunity here? Does it change in the law school? Does it change when you're already in professional practice?
Yeah, so, you know, one of the first steps is we've hired our first state defender, Chris Miles, and they're going to undertake appellate cases in South Dakota. You know, Chris is already doing a practicum program for our law students from the Minnehaha County Public Defender Office, and never miss an opportunity. I suggest to him that that might be a great thing to do in this new statewide office, and he agreed. So I think you'll see some law student opportunities there in coming days. I think for us, one of the things that I saw when I was federal defender is that the expertise of those lawyers that are in a structural indigent defense office to provide training and support for people taking cases out in the field is really significant. So training is a big priority for me and I think for the commission. And once Chris starts to get his hands around the appellate work, training is going to be a real focus. You know, there's some ongoing discussion with the state bar about training for lawyers generally. I think there's some synergy there. So I think training is going to be a big area where you're going to see an impact from the office and the commission early on.
Yeah. Were there things that any of you learned, and we'll start with the chief and then people can jump in afterwards, but were there things that you learned in this process that you didn't know or that were particularly gratifying to have some data to support what you thought was true about the system? Chief Jensen?
Yeah, I don't know that I saw a lot of big surprises. We had some things that were identified within our court system and things that we can improve in terms of how we're advising individuals of their right to counsel. Our judges are very conscientious about their obligation to explain constitutional rights to individuals. But the way we go about that and the way we explain that may impact how people understand that. As judges, we explain the law and we understand it. But we have many times we have people in front of us that maybe have never been in the court system before. And so I think as a court system, we need to think about how we're explaining rights to individuals and also talking about indigency. I mean, the reality of the situation is, you know, this isn't necessarily the, you know, looking at what the federal poverty level is, because if you have a significant criminal charge filed against you, someone earning a middle-class income is probably going to struggle to pay an attorney. And so making sure that we're providing counsel in those cases when individuals don't have the financial ability to pay counsel. And so those are probably two of the things that really stood out to me. I don't know if they were surprises, but I think they're important things to kind of turn a light bulb on and for us to think about as a court system. How can we get better in the way that we're talking about and explaining indigent defense to individuals as they come into the court system?
Yeah. Greg Satizan, anything you would add to that?
You know, one of the things that stood out to me was how quickly our defense costs have risen when we were looking at this as in at the statewide level. You know, the costs have doubled in about the last decade when you start to look at what counties are paying in indigent defense. And even in the last fiscal year, it went up by almost $2 million. And so you could really see significant growth. And it really made me appreciate what the counties, you know, were trying to respond to. You know, besides just being a large number, the costs are very unpredictable for our counties. And it's difficult to plan. You know, if you have a significant case, your budget from the prior year to that next year over can move dramatically. And, you know, as someone who administers a system, you know, being able to plan and account for those things are important, as, you know, those wild swings can be really difficult on stressed budgets. And so, you know, that was something that really, as you started to look at the numbers, became very clear how much dollars we're asking the counties to contribute. And then, you know, some of the variances of those costs, it's a very real thing.
Yeah. Dean Fulton, any further thoughts on that, or then we'll move forward to what happens next?
You know, one of the things I really learned was looking back at an evaluation of this issue in the 70s, many of the problems persist. Back then, they identified geography, availability of lawyers in smaller communities. And so I think one of the things I'm reminded in this is that there are some issues that are just going to be hard to tackle in a state like South Dakota because of how we literally are built. But I think that a difference from then and now is there was an evaluation of the issues and there wasn't the will to attack it. And so I'm really gratified here that what I see now is the will from the judiciary, from the bar on the defense and prosecution side, from law enforcement, from county governments and the legislature and the executive branch to really attack this problem and stick with a effort to develop a long-term solution. That's a big deal.
Yeah. We are going to hear this hour from Chief Defender Chris Miles, but I'd also want to ask each of you before I let you go, what is next? What are some of the steps that South Dakotans can be following in the days ahead? Dean Fulton, would you like to go first on that one?
I mean, you know, I will say first, Lori, that I want to, you know, use an analogy I use in other settings, that we're planting trees, not flowers here. I mean, flowers you drop in the ground, they grow fast and they die in the winter. We're growing a tree with this, and that takes time and persistence. And you look at that thing for many years and it seems like it isn't growing, but then eventually it's there and it endures. That's what this exercise is. So the first thing I would say for folks is, this is a conversation of years, not months and weeks. But things that I think you're going to see in coming months for us as the commission will be really attacking that question that the chief identified of getting some consistent guidance on identifying indigency and having people provide proof of indigency. Attacking that training piece that you talked about before, I think, is a thing that has a real ripple effect through the bar and improves the quality of representation in lots of cases. Helping Chris and his office get protocols in place to perfect appeals, take them in, centralize them, get those things going is really significant. You know, then helping the judiciary and other partners identify issues, whether it's data for the legislature, like Greg talked about, when they're looking at funding priorities, whether it's getting examples for the judiciary on practices from other jurisdictions. Those are going to be things we're going to focus on in the coming weeks. But this is a labor of years, not weeks and months.
Yeah. Greg, what would you add to that?
Yeah, I think definitely when I was trying to absorb the report and prioritize, there's certainly things that I think as a court system that we can begin to try to tackle right away. And so I'm imagining this will be our jumping off point to creating, you know, some work groups around, you know, the group advisement of rights and how our judges are doing their advisements of rights, and how we're, you know, informing defendants of their obligation under our current state law to repay attorney's fees. There were some of those things that I think are very inherent to the judicial process that we can work on. Outside of that, this is a significant partnership. We really have to be engaged with the policymakers, the legislature, the executive branch, the county governments, to keep pushing the ball forward. I heard Dean Fulton make comments about we really have to be persistent mm-hmm. on this issue. That's absolutely right. It's not a switch that you flip. It's going to be building a long-term process. And so we're going to have to prioritize what that looks like. And I think we can only do that if we, as system stakeholders, start talking about who's going to take the lead in what areas, and then what are the things that we can do to support each other, because it's going to take a lot of cooperation to implement and to try to make some improvements.
Can you say more, Greg, about this idea of advisement of rights by, like, giving us an example, or is it too soon to talk about how something can be done better? Like, help us understand what that means in real life.
Yeah, so the report had the opportunity to go in and spend a lot of times a lot of time in seven of our counties, and they observed judicial practices and were able to draw some distinctions there. And so when a person's accused of a crime, they'll go in and the judge is going to advise them of, you know, their right to counsel and you know, their other rights associated with, you know, the criminal justice system that's protected by our Constitution. And so every judge has a unique way of doing that. And while they're all in many respects similar, they can be different. And we've never really talked about that as a system. You know, what can we provide that would make it so that nothing is missed, or that as that advisement is being done, we're engaged in the people that are hearing the rights to make sure that they're understanding, that they're able to participate in that process. You know, just based on the volume, as you look at different counties, in some counties, you're going to have multiple defendants that are there after a long weekend that the judge has to advise the rights on. And so you're going to have several people in the courtroom. It's not necessarily always a one-on-one interaction, but how do we make sure that all of them are engaged? And so that's really important for a person to understand, you know, as this process moves forward, what are the rights that they have so they can, you know, meaningfully think about their case and moving forward and next steps.
Yeah. Chief Justice Stephen Jensen, I'd like to give you the last word. What is next in your mind?
Yeah, you know, I heard Dean Fulton and Greg talk about some of the details, and I know they're much more focused on those. When I step back and look at the big picture, I've always seen this process as two steps. The first step being, you know, creating the statewide commission and starting that public defender office. And we've completed that step. The second step is extending that public defender office into the trial courts around the state. That's a huge step. It's going to take a lot of work. And I think that's the part that Dean Fulton is talking about, you know, not days, but years. But I'm optimistic about the process. When I think about, you know, back to 3 years when this was just a discussion, if you had told me 3 years ago that we were going to be as far as we are today, I'm not sure I would have believed that. And so I'm optimistic moving forward. While we've got a lot of work to do on this, you know, implementing this process in the trial courts, I think we've got a lot of momentum, and I think there's a lot of interest and a realization that, you know, this is really about, you know, our freedoms, what we do as a country, and the efficacy of our judicial system, and people seeing that we have a fair system and a fair process for every person that comes into our courts.
You heard there from South Dakota Supreme Court Chief Justice Stephen Jensen, Neil Fulton, Dean of the University of South Dakota Knutson School of Law, and Greg Satizon, the South Dakota State Court Administrator. You're listening to In the Moment on SDPB. I'm Lori Walsh. With the creation of the Office of Indigent Legal Services came a new position, Chief Defender. Now, South Dakota's first Chief Public Defender is Chris Miles. Let's get to know more about him and his new role.
So I grew up in Brookings, South Dakota. I went to high school there, graduated from SDSU, went to law school in St. Paul at William Mitchell College of Law, came back to South Dakota, started working at the Minnehaha County Public Defender's Office, and I've been there since 2015.
What will this new role have you doing? Explain it to us.
Yeah. So the new role as the Chief Defender, I'd say I'm kind of the right-hand man right now for the commission. So the commission has certain duties, and I think a lot of what my job will be is to employ and apply some of those standards, some of the new protocols that the state is looking to put in place to ensure that indigent defendants across the state have quality representation and have access to it.
So you start out wanting to go into the public defender's office. For what reason? Why were you drawn to that area of the law?
Well, you know, Lori, a lot of times I think it's easy for the public to maybe see a news story about some heinous crime that has occurred. But what we get to do at the public defender's office is to really get to know the individual behind that news story, understand the circumstances and the context, and really help them through that process. It's a very difficult process for them, as you can imagine. Mm-hmm. A lot of tough decisions to make. So we get to use all of that information and present it to the court and ideally put the client in the best position. And so that's really fulfilling.
This role then, what made you want to step into this area?
Well, when I saw that the chief defender was going to be something that was primarily handling the appellate cases, that was certainly something that drew my attention.
Tell people what that means.
Doing the appellate work, what we're looking to do really is to determine if there was a legal error that was made in the underlying case, and then seek a remedy for that. So we would be appealing to a higher court here in South Dakota. We are appealing to the South Dakota Supreme Court, and potentially getting a new trial, having a conviction vacated for certain reasons, or potentially having a new sentencing hearing, things of that nature. So that is something that I've been doing at the public defender's office for the majority of my time there. You know, that is a way that I've really been able to recognize I'm doing more for the state as well, yeah. Not just the client. It's very important to the client, but I've had times where attorneys from across the state have reached out to me and told me, you know, a certain decision was very helpful for them as they were working a case at the trial level. And I think when I hear stuff like that, I realize the appellate work has a pretty broad impact.
Yeah. So the idea of this being important not only to your client, but it also is in support of justice and therefore in support of all of us. The U.S. Constitution mandates that we do this well.
Of course. And that is one of the primary goals here. We have this Sixth Amendment Center report that we've been talking about here in the news. One of the primary issues that we have here in the state is that many of the individuals accused of crimes in some of the more rural areas do not have access to attorneys that are able to, you know, even get to them,
right.
To access them. And sometimes the attorneys also have some conflicts with regard to their ability to represent that individual when they have many other things going on, whether it's in their private practice or other court-appointed cases.
Yeah. So you will be the first person to hold this position, and you're laying the groundwork that is new. How do you approach leadership? How do you approach the very beginnings of this and laying a foundation that's strong so that it continues to build into a robust program?
Well, you know, when we think about attorneys, we often think argumentative, you know, the adversarial process comes to mind. And that's certainly the right way to handle cases at the trial court level and representing clients. I think here with this position, I'm going to need to take a more collaborative approach and really speak with county commissioners, prosecutors, judges, all of those stakeholders that really have the ability to make the changes that we think are necessary.
Any final thoughts you want to leave people with?
This is an important moment. I think we have some momentum, mm-hmm. and certainly we don't have a path in front of us, but I will do my best to leave a trail and see if we can really move things forward for the betterment of indigent defendants across the state.
That was Chris Miles, South Dakota's first chief public defender. We'll bring you more on this story as it develops. That's our show for today. We hope that it served you. If you miss a live in the moment, you can always go to our podcast feed on any podcast platform, scroll through, find your favorite topic, and take a listen. From all of us at SDPB, I'm Lori Walsh, and thank you for listening.